Welcome back to The Punchline, episode 5 from Matchroom Boxing, supported by JD Sports. I'm your host, Tom Davis, and today I'm over the moon to be joined by the bomber, Tony Bellew.
Happy days, mate. Is it just me and you on?
It is, my brother, yeah. Scott's always in the background, lurking.
I'm sweating like a pig. I've just finished on a Peloton, mate.
Fucking... Are you on the Peloton number as well?
I've just finished, yeah, mate. You know what? I was going out there during lockdown on 3-hour bike rides, and all the fucking... coppers in the world are going, you shouldn't be out for 3 hours, you're only allowed an hour's exercise. I was like, fuck off. So I was out on my bike for 3 hours a day, and then my missus started whinging, so I said, but what do you want me to do? So she went, what am I supposed to do? So I had to fucking buy a Peloton, didn't I?
Those Pelotons, right, are like addicted. So all our, look, I ain't met you properly before, but we have got a lot of mutual pals. Romesh is obsessed with it. Freddie does that. Mate, he's got like the fucking nutty thing with it, right? Freddie's like one of my best pals, but I see Freddie, like, I've just done the League of Their Own this series, and he's gone from, like, when we were doing the road trip, he was like fucking stacked. He looked like a Greek god, and now he's like fucking, he looks like a cyclist. He looks incredible. Like,
it's amazing what he's done, mate. Good on him. But I don't know how they're getting them fucking numbers. He's a cricketer, fucking hell. It's fucking shocking.
I bought one of those. They were saying to me to get one, right? And then I looked into it, and they were like, so I contacted them. I was like, yeah, I'm up for looking at one of these Pelotons. And they were like, da, da, da. I said, look, but I'm like, at the time, I'm 22 stone and I'm 6'7". And they were like, oh, I'm not too sure about that. I'm not too sure if you're too big. No, so now I'm about to buy an assault bike, Tony, one of those fucking air bikes. Mate, they're fucking hardcore.
They are horrible things, and especially when you've given a calories amount to actually burn on its own, that's when it gets horrible. And we do them by calories you've got to burn, so you'll have to do like 10 calories in X amount of time, and then you go in the gym and the lads are all trying to beat each other. It's nearly as bad as the rowing machine.
Oh, mate, I think rowers are hardcore. I've got that thing, and I was doing the thing the other day where I think you've got to do like, you do like 250, you do 250, whatever yards, what, bam bam, and then you fight, then 500, 1,000, and then between it, you meters. Get, yeah. Mate, it's fucking, because like, do you know what? I got your thing. Remember when, I think it was after the Usyk fight, you launched a program? Because I was
the
getting
only time I had the six pack.
Mate, you were incredible, Nick, then. You're an incredible Nick. But yeah, I was like, I got that, I brought that thing to do it.
Thank you.
It's blinded, man. It was incredible.
It's all right, mate. It's all right. The lad who put it together and put me with it was a clever boy. I'm thick as fuck. But he was clever, mate. He knew what he was doing.
Was that the fight? That was the shape of your life, do you reckon?
No, I actually felt, because I had to make weight, I was a little bit, it was tough making weight. But I'd say the shape I was ever, the best I ever felt, although I even had a bad injury going into the fight, was the Hay set, the Hay 2 fight. The Hay rematch was just, I was in the best shape, and mentally I was just so zoned in on it that it was I was just in great, great shape.
Those two fights was like, I was a fan of yours anyway, and I loved you. And I've said about this on numerous things, like when I've talked to Spencer and Jake or whoever, like I think you're, you know, like now you've retired and watching you as a pundit, you're like, listening to you dissect fighting. I remember when Anthony was fighting, and listening to you break down fights before the fight is incredible. It's genuinely, I love my boxing. My dad talks about you and is like, Tony Bellew, the way Tony Bellew breaks down a fight and is incredible. But
try and just give it to people the way I'm watching it, but then there's a difficult way to watching some boxing fights, and there is a science behind it, but I try and just break it down as basic as possible of what he needs to do to win, what he needs to do. And then I also try and bring in what the attributes are of each fighter. So, you know, when the likes of Klitschko and AJ are fighting, you know AJ has got to get close and rough Klitschko up, and you know Klitschko needs to dominate with the jab and maintain a distance from early on. So I enjoy breaking fights down. I just don't do it as much as I should or to get asked, because I don't want to be constantly made on the TV, and being totally honest, I don't want to... I enjoy doing a little bit and then coming away for quite a while, and then doing a little bit and then coming away. Don't get me wrong, when I first retired, I wanted to basically disappear. I hated the media. I hated fame. And then once you're away for a while, you think, all right, well, I'm not in any fucking money and I'm bored out my tits. So I've got to do something. And then Ed always comes on. Ed's always been there and looked out for us. So there's numerous things I've got going on, but it's just it's about staying. I don't want to say the word relevant, but just staying busy.
Because that's the amazing thing, I think, because I didn't know that about you. And like I remember first seeing you on League of Their Own, and like, but even like when I was like watching you as a boxer and as like just as a sportsman in general, you've got like, you're charismatic. You're always like, you know, on the lead up to those Hay fights, they were saying it just like, I remember me and my pals were like, just you, it was like you were just in this place. And it was just like, you felt like, you know, growing up around the way where I grew up, and if you were going to have a row with someone, but if someone had that glint in their eye and that little way about them, you'd, your arsehole would go and you'd be getting on the bus home. Man. Do you know what I mean? But you just had that. So I think that I always thought with you as a boxer, and just, you know, when you're breaking down sports people, you're like, this guy is going to fucking be great when he, as a pundit. So I always just thought a natural fit for you. And on League of Their Own, you're fucking hilarious. Like when you were doing the plane thing with Jay, one of my favourite things ever on that. But you're funny.
I just see myself as a big dope. I never see myself as being funny, or I don't try and tell jokes, because if I do try and tell a joke or I try and be funny, it just comes across as so cringeworthy. So like, I never watch myself back on TV. The only time I watch myself back is when I've been getting punched in the face, and I'm only watching myself back to see the mistakes I was making, but why I got punched. So I just can't, everyone goes on to me and says, oh, you're good on this, you're good on that, but I don't watch myself back, so I don't know I'm being portrayed. Like, I've never seen SAS back. I've never seen any broadcasting I've done for Sky back. I'll put it on. Like, I've come home and study fights that I've meant to have been watching, and then I'll forward my bit, and then I'll just watch the fight. So the AJ Klitschko one, I'll watch back. I studied and seen the mistakes both guys were making. Dillian White, I've been watching lately because, you know, I've got a bit of work coming up on him on the 22nd. Povetkin. So I've been studying him and Povetkin, watching them. So many flaws and mistakes that both of them make, but Dillian just, the size plays a massive part. So I say I'm always studying and watching. I don't study as much of the younger generation coming through now as I should do, which I will start getting to more now that I've got a bit more time. But that's about it, mate.
It's interesting you say that about, because that I don't ever think about, like, when I do that shows and when I do stuff, like, I never go into it with written jokes. And like, when I do, like, Romish is like my best pal, and like, and he'll always say, like, if you think about stuff too much, you're never as good. If I just go in and I'm a big lump who just says stuff, and but I'm like, I can never watch anything I do back, man. I can never,
it's cringe, really, mate. I'm the same. Ramesh, I love Ramesh. Ramesh is a funny guy.
Oh, man, I love that.
I've got a good click with him up here. He's a cracking guy. But I'm the same. I just couldn't go into something. Don't get me wrong, I've gone into certain things. The only time I remember going into something with a clear agenda of what I was going to do was when I defended the WBC title against BJ Flores. I told Eddie Hearn, I didn't want to fight BJ Flores because I thought he was a wanker. That was the first thing. But I agreed to it anyway, because Eddie was adamant on it, because he was David Hay's best mate. So I said, the only way I'll fight BJ Flores is if you get David Hay to be reporting ringside. If you get him to commentate on the fight, I'll do it. And he went, what's David Hay got? I said, you just get David Hay ringside. And my plan was always clear. As soon as I became world champion, I just needed to make as much money as fast as possible. Yeah. And David Hay had the biggest fucking pound sign on the front of his head. It was like the fella in Red Dwarf with H. David had the pound sign nailed to his forehead. So I always talked to David Hay, and I always knew genuinely deep down how decent just styles make fights. It's just how boxing works sometimes. He'd beat fighters who I don't think I'd beat. So a fighter who he beat was John Mark Mormack. I don't think I'd have beat John Mark Mormack. I think he'd have worn me down and got to me in the end. But I always believe I'd beat David Hay. It's just, as I say, styles make fights. He beats him, I beat him.
But it's an amazing thing that's what I found. And like, I remember, like I say, chatting to pals, and like, those fights are massive. Like, you know, and like, but the confidence, like, you were, like, you know, you had, like, on the running up to it. Yeah, no, but
that's what people say. Where is your confidence coming from?
Yeah, but that's the thing. Like, where is that's just an inner belief of yourself, right? That's just
I always believed deep down. Don't get me wrong, there was some fights I wasn't. So when I was approaching the Usyk fight, I was pretty much, I was happy with how my career had gone, and I was happy. I was challenging the best fighter in the world, the number one pound for pound. In and around my division, without a shadow of a doubt. So I'm not saying. I thought I could beat him. I believed if I got the tactics right, if I believed if I'd done everything right, and a little bit of luck in the fight went my way when it needed to, I'd beat him. But if I lost to him, I wasn't going to be as disappointed, as heartbroken as I usually would be, because I could actually, for once in my life, go, well, he's genuinely better than me. So yeah. I could take that, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? I was happy in my life, and that's the reason why I adjusted so well after losing to Usyk. Usually, mate, I would be depressed or down. I wouldn't come out the house for days. I would hide myself away, because I was always telling the public, I'm going to be world champion. I'm going to do this. I'm going to knock you out. And that just heaps so much pressure on yourself mentally that it's hard to get away from when it doesn't go right, mate, which has only been a couple of times in my career. It's absolutely heartbreaking. It's the worst. It's the loneliest place in the world of boxing when you've lost. But after the Usyk fight, I was able to, I suppose I've matured a little bit and I've grown up a little bit as well. But I was in a happy place where I thought, he's the best. There's no shame in losing to him. The fucker was that good.
But also the first opening, because I had money on you in that fight. And
That's all right.
Because you, mate, I remember sitting, I watched that with my wife, because my wife, since we've been together, she's got more and more into boxing. She loves it. Okay. And she was like, but she comes at it as an emotional thing, right? So straight away, she's like, you know, she watched the Hay fights. So she loved you. She loved you, like what you stood for as a family man and as a good guy. So that early, that fight, like when you're coming out, you know, when you're just like, oh, mate, he could do this here. It's just, you're like, you're already popping the champagne.
Oh, mate, it was going great for the first six, but I got tired. As I said, fighting David A twice a heavyweight. That's why the David A rematch, I'd adjusted to heavyweight. It was my second fight there. I was just so happy. And mate, I fought him with a cracked rib in the rematch. Did because, you? Yeah, the opponent, his name was Ty Mitchell, broke me ribs before the Usyk fight. He cracked it again. Before the David Hay fight, a big kid come over called, what was his fucking, I'm punchy fucker. I forgot his name. It begins with M, Malachi or Massa. Something. He was a kid from London, and fuck me, cracked me rib with 2 weeks to go before the Hay fight. And then Dave Caldwell shitting his pants in the gym thinking, oh my God, we are fucked. And I just went in. I was in a hyperbaric chamber for 2 weeks before the fight, solid, in and out every morning for 2 weeks. And it built a layer of tissue over the crack. But every time I'd twist down to my left for the body shot, it would hurt and twinge. If David would have had the nose to have dug me body in the first couple of rounds, he'd have snapped it and I'd have probably been out like a light, mate, screaming on the floor with a broken rib. But he didn't. Unfortunately, I performed out my skin. I say that I feel that night the best I ever performed in a boxing ring, because he took me seriously in the rematch. He knew how dangerous I really was, and he knew how hard I punched. So he prepared to the best of his ability. And I knew I was going in up against it, because everyone was going, you only beat him because he had one leg and you're shit and you're not in his league. So I knew, and everything kept saying, building up to the rematch, kept saying, I'm going to do him faster and I'm going to do him more clinically. He's not even going to touch me, and he didn't. He's going to say, that was the best I performed. Not my best night of boxing. My best night was Goodison Park, obviously, but my best night I performed was definitely Hay 2.
But that were the those legacy fight type things. You had them, obviously, like, you know, the winning titles, but they were the fights that people will always remember. Do you know what I mean? They're the fights of, and that's as a fighter, you know, I think titles are, you know, it's like where you're talking about Dillian but him versus Chisora. That I was at that first fight. You know, and you just, you know, and I think you versus Dave. And I was so happy you fought him. You know, interesting story, right?
Cool.
I made a show called Murder and Successful a couple of years ago. And David Hay was, when he fought you in that first fight, he was booked to do that show. And they were like, everyone was going, da, da, da. I was like, I don't think, and it was literally 2 weeks after the show, he was going to be doing it. And I was like, I don't think he's, and obviously when when he did his leg, I was like, we were like phoning around trying to get fucking someone to come in.
I'm like, surprised he never went on, and mate, he's a hungry fucker. I'm surprised he still never went on with his cast on.
Are you still in contact? How does it work? Like, with
Delboy's my good friend. Delboy's like family to me. So Delboy asked me to manage him before he went to David, and I said, Derek, I said, okay, I said, I'll help you. I'm not going to manage you. He said, you've got to take your percentage if you manage me. I said, well, I'm not managing you because I'm not taking a percentage out of your money. It's your money. You've earned it. So he wouldn't come with me because I wouldn't take a percentage out of his money. So he went with David. And it was a great move because David is very good publicity-wise. You know, he's very good with the media. He's a media darling, shall we say, whereas I'm just fucking straight up. I don't fit the cut that they kind of want, like, thing. And I'll just say it. I will see it sometimes, which isn't very good. media wise, unless of course I'm on Sky Sports talking about boxing, and then I keep my mouth.
But then I think people like people who say it as is. I think people, I don't think the media necessarily do, but no, I think people don't. I think people,
genuine real people,
they like people who come from what, you know, the very nature of who you are and where you come from. And, you know, I think a certain amount of my success comes to the fact I spent 20 years on a building site. Like, I think I came to this at, you know, at a late age. I was 32 by the time I got into comedy.
Makes you appreciate it so much.
Yeah, man. But people
I used to be a labourer.
Yeah, were you a labourer?
Oh, mate, I've been a labourer. Yeah, it didn't last long because I was boxing for England and doing labouring in the day and then boxing at night. And it was so hard, mate. I think I was getting 150 a week and just carrying buckets of shit up and downstairs. Oh, mate, we were ripping out a nightclub in Liverpool, building a new one, and I was labouring on there. And then it was formerly a gym. So I had to knock down a sauna with a sledgehammer. And I always remember, I've got this scar on my finger here.
Fuck yeah.
Well, I whacked it. I smacked the sauna down with the sledgehammer, and as I done it, I got the sledgehammer pole caught there and whacked down on a tile on my finger. Fuck. And that was it's never gone straight ever since, that finger. It's constantly a crooked bend. That
worst.
One goes straight, and it must have deadened the nerves, and it's never gone straight. Oh, mate. And that was my last day on a building site. My dad just said, "You're not cut out for this, son." Then I started working at the pillar factory. I worked the next. I was a lifeguard. I worked on the door of a weekend. That was eventful. So many jobs. So I'd say you coming into things late. And then I'd say for me, success for me financially didn't come until the very last five fights in my career. So I was fighting for buttons. I was skimp, mate, as a world champion. I never had no money in the bank. It's crazy. I was British Commonwealth, European world champion, and I never had a fucking pot of piss in.
That's the thing, though. It gives you so much more, that like now, like those rewards, even for myself, I look at it, and like when you talk about, I remember like I left school at 15, 16. I was like, my dad was like, "We'll go out on the building site." So I was hog carrying. And then he's like, "You need to get a trade." Hog carrying was a killer, bro. And then I was like, right. And then so I was like, scaffolding was like, I just used to look at scaffolders and they were fucking about, and they never looked like they did. They looked like they do the least amount of work, but have the most amount of fun. And that's, you know what, right, Tom, when people say to me about, when I talk to people and they say about, "Oh, did you always want to be a comedian?" I always wanted to be like, there was an old scaffolder called George Beasley, right? He had enough money for a fucking season ticket at Tottenham. I'm not a Tottenham fan. he was out every weekend on the hour. Everyone respected him. I thought, I want to be that geezer.
I want to be like him.
I never ever had any fucking dreams of like doing what I do now, which I'm blessed and whatever. But my ambitions were just enough to be a fixer on a scaffold site and be in a relationship where I was allowed to go down a boozer 3-4 times a week.
Well, I've got one of them. I'm definitely not allowed to go down a boozer the once a week. Mate, I wear the keks in this house, but she tells me what colour to put on.
Mate, I'm so with you at that. Like, I've just started playing golf. Jamie just got me in, so I started going down having a little knockabout. And she's like, "Yeah, once a week." And I'm like, you know, like, I don't know if you've played, but I've got to start getting addicted.
I am, mate. I'm addicted. I've got a lesson at 1 o'clock today. At 12 o'clock.
Oh, mate, I'm all like, I love it, right?
I love it.
I'm starting to sort of like go, I might just pop down a supermarket and like, try and go to the fucking garage and sneak out your fucking clubs.
The golf clubs and go down the driving range. Do you know what? The more I've spent quite a bit of time at the driving range practicing lately, but it's completely different to getting out and playing. You've just got to get out and play, because I am the dog's bollocks on the driving range. I'm telling you now, I'm clearing 200 yards with the 7-iron, no problem. Wow. On the driving range, I can belt a ball on the driving range, but then I'll get on the course and it's just going to fucking pot. I'm hitting 9s, 10s on some holes. But don't get me wrong, like, I played on what day are we on today? We're on Wednesday. I played on Sunday and I went round in 102. But I parred 4 or 5 holes, but then I hit 3 9s, and it's just like I wanted to smash me clubs, because that's 27 shots. If I just hit 3 5s, that's 12 off, knocked off, you know what I mean? And I was just like, fuck.
The anger you feel, right? So I had exactly the same thing. I played last Friday, and I went round, first few holes were all right. Then I came to the first time I've ever played up, like, teeing off over water. putting fucking four balls into the water. Then there's these four fucking old guys, posh old boys going out, you know, you really need to get under it. And really, and I'm like, fuck, mate, I know what I need to fucking do. My head knows what I need to do, but my ability is not fucking there, is it? You know what I mean?
Oh, like, mate, that's
I'm
exactly
not sitting there trying to look like an absolute cunt. I'm fucking like,
the worst thing is, mate, I've got a bag, a tailor-made bag, a proper tour bag with my name on it, the Everton badge on it. I turn up, I've got all the gear, and mate, I look fucking fantastic. When I turn up, one of my mates who plays off two, I turned up and he just said, you are definitely a single handicap golfer. And I just said to him, the only handicap about me, mate, is when I pick up a golf club, I am handicapped. And he looked at me as if he didn't find it funny. And I said, well, I'm just saying what I see, mate. This is exactly what you're going to get. I hit the first tee shot and it just went completely out of bounds. And just went completely get you now. I understand where you're coming from. I told you.
My wife went, you've not only brought the clubs, the bag and all that, I've brought like a whole Nike fucking, I've got one of these cupboards that's just full of fucking, like, I've got cardigans, polo shirts.
But I love the gear, the belt on, the shirt tucked in.
Oh, I love it.
Strut out my house. It's boss me, but then I say I do look like a bit of a fucking weirdo.
I've got obsessed with just looking at like how Michael Jordan rolls when he's out there. Like Jordan's out and Jordan's still wearing the trousers he wore in the 90s without it. Like, mm-hmm. I'm like, mate, this geezer's like, I'm a big fella. I'm like, I'm thinking about hitting those big fucking baggy pants.
Like, I still haven't watched that documentary of his, but I'll have to get to it, mate. I've still got to watch it.
He's around there with that and a big cigar, and he's literally like, he's just as cool as fuck, isn't he? He's
Michael Jordan, mate. He's fucking, he's the dog's bollocks.
Do you find like, so when it comes to golf, because that's a bit like, you're just saying about there, and like, that's the one thing I think when I watched you as a fighter as well, like, you had like that steady, you never felt like things were just getting on. You always felt like you were cool in the ring. Like that, I think that's the thing that impressed me much on the run up to the Hay fight. There was, like I say, it was that thing of, you know, when you come from there and you worked on the doors, you come from, you know, like Liverpool, I'm assuming, like I come from a like rough enough place. Like if someone's shouting in my face and really going at me, I'm a bit like, you're doing all your fighting now. Do you know what I mean? Yeah,
I was always, I never panicked. I like fighting, Tom. It's this fucking sick thing that I've got in my mind, but I enjoy having a fight, whether it would be anyway. I like having a fight. So I never, ever got nervous. I've only ever been nervous for two fights in my life. My first ever amateur fight and the fight at Goodison Park.
Yeah.
I've just never been nervous. I'd be in the dressing room before, and Eddie or anyone can tell you before when they come in my changing room, they were like, he's not nervous, he's relaxed. I would be watching jokes. So I remember watching 90 for the last four or five fights of my career, I found a joke. Well, it's not a joke, it's a sketch that's played. It's called the Matrix. If you put in the Matrix, what's it called? The male Matrix on YouTube. And it's a man basically breaking down women and how they think and what they're after and what they should do. And then it's hilarious. Just put it in the male Matrix.
I'll have a look at it. Male Matrix.
And I used to just watch that when I was getting my hands wrapped before a fight, and my whole dressing room would be in tears of laughter before the biggest fight in my life. And we would just cry laughing at this video, mate. It was brilliant. And that's what I'd do. So I just never got nervous in fights, and I was always calm. Even when I was in the ring, I was never scared. Like, a lot of fighters are really good on the front foot, but they're actually scared of getting hit. So when the pressure's really on them on the side, you see them like cower down and toughen up. I wasn't asked, mate. What's the worst that can happen? You can knock me out. You can put me on my ass. It's been done before. So it's nothing new to me. If that's the worst you can do to me, then fucking bring it on. Just don't forget, there's another side to that coin. I can knock you out. I can fucking chin you. And I just had that frame set, that mindset going in. And it was just, I love it. That's the part I miss the most. I don't miss anything else apart from just purely fighting.
You're listening to The Punchline from Matchroom Boxing. Here's a short message from our partners at JD Sports.
Yo, what's good, people? I hope you're enjoying Matchroom Boxing's Punchline. I just wanted to let you know, though, about the JD in a Duffel Bag podcast hosted by myself, Chucky Online, and Rebecca Dudley. We got some real interesting conversations with the likes of Anthony Joshua, Eddie Hearn, and Maya Jama. Just search JD in a Duffel Bag podcast on your favorite podcast app right now, yeah?
How do you think you can ever, I mean, like, because that's the thing, right? It's that, like, I found that a little bit with, like, so I started stand up. Me and Rom started about, and then Rom, obviously stand up was his thing, but then I weirdly fell into like acting and writing, and then that became, and then I went back and gigged with Rom last year. And then he's like, you know, he said to me for a long time, get back into the stand. And I missed the stand up because I missed that fit. Like when you're filming a like sitcom or a film or whatever, you're going into it and you kind of know what the script is and da da da. And
I love doing that. That was the best. I really enjoyed filming.
Because really you did Creed, right?
Yeah, the Creed. Yeah, I really enjoyed that. That was brilliant.
Did you find that you've got that same adrenaline there? Or?
It was a different kind of adrenaline, but I enjoyed doing it. To be honest, when I first came home after doing it, I regretted doing it because my little boy had just been born when I left. And when I came home, I was living in Philadelphia for 3 months and I didn't come home, didn't see my family for 3 months. I lived with them through FaceTime and that was very, very hard. But when I first came back, I kind of regretted doing it. Excuse me. But as soon as I seen it and all the work that we put into it, I was like, that's brilliant. It was well worth it. But it was amazing to see the transformation. But listen, that's down to the director, Ryan Coogler. The boy's a genius, mate. He's just an unbelievable person and a fantastic director of what he does.
It's incredible. I mean, the film was amazing. How did you find the... Because that's the thing I found weird when I started doing, like, big film. Like, there were 3 big films on the bounce. And I found them, like, from going from doing small BBC shows or doing a gig, like, a stand-up gig isn't... But where you look at a boxing match, you go out. I mean, dying on stage in a stand-up gig is there's nothing worse for me. It's like, man, fuck me. I remember like doing a festival called Download, which was a heavy metal festival, and I came on stage and I'm in fucking Nike Airs. It's all fucking these guys dressed in black, and I was like, oh man, I come out and I'm fucking dressed in like fucking whatever, like a Ralph t-shirt, and the whole place starts booing, and I thought, fuck it. Like, you're not going to like me. So I start throwing things at them and start like fucking giving it to them. And then they start throwing, right? And I turn to the geezer and I'm like, how long have I got to do? He's like, you know, 20 minutes. So I was like, they're booing, they're shouting. And then someone threw a bottle of piss.
Oh, mate.
The piss hits me. And he was like, was that piss? And I went, yeah. He went, get off now. I got off there and I was sold. Like, although it wasn't my crowd, whatever. Like, to have like, whatever it was, like 1,500 people booing you. I was like, mate, I just
that
went home.
That must have made you so resilient, though, going forward, because nothing can ever get any worse than that.
No, but then also, so like, when you talk about those jobs you did and like that, my first gigs were all like proper. They weren't normally like a lot of people would do gig. I did a lot of like working men's clubs. So I did a lot of like rugby club dues, football club dues, boxing dinners, whatever. So it was like really rough. And so when I first started doing the circuit, as they call it in London, and they go, oh, it could be a bit rough in here. I was like, fucking 2 geezers with a baseball bat fucking were trying to smash up my car after the last fucking gig. So, and just the nature of like, you know, working on a building site, you know, yourself, like you sink or swim. I was never like yourself. I was never like, I'm going to have a row, I'm going to have a fight. I could have a fight type thing. All I knew was, I'd banter and I'd have a laugh. And my
your banter
dad said
level
to me,
was on 100, mate. When you work on a building site, your banter level has to be high. It's like football, being in a football dressing room. I've played football all my life. And if you can't survive in a football, if you can, sorry, survive in a football dressing room, you can survive anywhere, mate, because the banter in a football dressing room is just, there's no barriers. There's no racial barrier. There's no colour barrier, no creed. Everyone is just into the pot and you just rip the fucking back out of each other. And it's basically last man standing. And I've been in them situations many times and I give just as good as I get. So I'm much better. That's why with David A, I just bounced off him. He has no natural wit and quick banter. So every time he'd say something, I would just spring something off my mind quick.
But that's the other thing.
I don't know where it comes from.
But what I found interesting with that and chatting to you, as I say, being a fan of your stuff, is as a boxer, you clearly take yourself seriously for that. But actually, as a geezer who's got banter, you have a feeling like you say about like building sites and stuff. The big thing for me isn't how much you can give it; it's how much you can take that shit and not get upset by it, and then come back with it. Yeah. But you to do that, you've got to almost be a bit self-deprecating. You've got to go, oh, you know, whatever, and you can have the banter. Whereas whenever I watch David, I always think, and certain other boxers, if you take yourself so seriously.
Yeah.
And someone gets inside your head a little bit too much. Like
sometimes you've got to be able to just laugh at yourself, mate.
Yeah.
If you can't laugh at yourself, then you're absolutely fucked. I'm able to laugh at myself at times. I'm able to think, I just don't take things too seriously. Don't get me wrong, unless I'm Middleton screaming in my face, I'm not really that bothered.
So that's what I wanted to talk to you about, because like when I heard you was doing that show, I was like, knowing, like literally I'd listened to your interviews and like, you know, I'm a bit of a fan. I just think like you as a, you for me as a fan, I always felt you felt like the most, you know, regardless of Liverpool, like whatever, you know, but you felt like the most sort of like a geezer, technically incredible, brilliant. Thank like you. Your knowledge of, but you of boxing was incredible. But the main thing I always found with you is you felt like you earned the right to those hay fights, the title fights. You come up the tough way. It wasn't like just given to you. So that gives you a sort of identification with the working man, with the viewer, right? But then but I'd listened to a lot of stuff you said. So when I heard you were doing SAS, and I sort of knew how that show, and I know I've Ant's like someone I've met a number. So me and Ant did a charity thing. He's like I've never met anyone like straight away that thing of like, you know, boxer could be whatever, but this guy's gone first fucking into rooms and fucking you know for us as a country, right? And I remember we did this charity day. Me and Ant were like two of the first people there, and we're getting pictures and whatever. And then I said to her, like, some other people got there, some other sort of like fucking pop stars and people that have X Factor or whatever. So they come there for about 10, 15 minutes, Tone, and then Ant turns around and then they leave. And I said, what sort of time are you going? And Ant's like, I don't respect anyone on a charity day who comes in for 10, 15 minutes and fucks off. For me, you're here for a day. It's a charity day, right? So he's like, you staying with me, big man? And I had dinner with my wife. I had a lunch with a pal. I end up, right, I get there at 9 a.m. At 7 o'clock, I'm still there with Ant Middleton, right? Because he won't let me go home and beer with him. And then I was like, mate, I'm done. I'm going home. And he was like, he'd got a suit delivered to go out with all the people. But he was like, he took it so seriously. He's a real gent, isn't he?
He's a diamond, mate. He'd be one of the best people I've ever met in my life. Just an absolute diamond of a fella. And the most positive man I've ever known. I wish I could just have him living on my shoulder, to be honest. But that's would be perfect for me.
But did you find, I find with all of them, I think Foxy's just like...
Foxy's a boss fella.
Yeah.
Oddly's great. Jay Morton's good, very quiet, reserved within himself. Billy, Mark Billingham is just... I admired all of them so much. That's the reason I done it. I didn't do it because... for TV reasons or whatever. I just wanted to go in. I've always admired guys high up in the military. That's the reason I went in. I've always thought I'd love to be like them. You know, I went and done the test for the Navy. I passed the test for the Navy. And then the week before I was supposed to go, I pulled out at the last minute after I'd passed the physical exam. I'd done the fire brigade test. I passed that. I'd done the physical and I passed that. And then I pulled out on them all with literally a week to go before I was supposed to join because I wanted to pursue the career of being a world champion boxer. So I could have been a fireman, I could have been in the Navy, and I said, passed both of the tests for them, and then just spewed it at the last minute. So I've always looked up to them guys, and spending time with them, listening to some of the stories, the things that they've done, it's just, and they've done it all, and none of what them guys have done has been for financial gain.
No.
It's all been purely for the love of their country and wanting to defend it. And putting bad people in the ground, mate, which is just, it's just the ultimate sacrifice what they've given to this country.
When you're doing a show like that, when you're doing that show, and it's like one of my favourite shows, I watch every series of it, but do you have that? Because obviously when you're watching it, there's a big separation between you guys and them, and, you know, they're putting you through your paces, but do you get to know them as well as guys during that time, or was it more after?
I didn't know them at all before, and I didn't get to know them while I was there. You know, the best you probably got off them was a wink to say you've done well.
Yeah, well done. That means a lot, though, right?
Yeah, it means a lot when you're in there, or a little nod of the head. They'd never really pull you to the side and talk to you or stuff like that. You know, the odd word of keep going, big man, keep pushing, big man, keep trying. That would be the best you get. It was a... I've now listened to all the audio books. I've bought the bleeding books as well, just to sort of put a few quid in the pocket to try and say thanks. But they're just great people, mate, as I say, and I look up to them so much. I really, really do. It's like having your uncle.
Yeah.
Push it and push it and push it. You've got so much respect for them anyway, and you respect your elders and stuff, but it's actually what they've done that stands out so much, and I say I don't take orders from anyone. I never have. And that was the biggest thing for me going. And everyone thought I was going to flip me lid and belt someone or kick off or cause a ruck. I had far too much respect for them to take that approach.
I read Ant's book, and like through myself, I think even like going through that, you know, that mental battle of, you know, like I say, coming to this industry late, you go through, you know, your mates change, your world changes, right? I've got some friends who I'm still pals with, some friends who have been dickheads, some friends who change. I don't feel I have, but I think the nature of your mental health is tested, especially coming into lockdown. I was like, fuck, like, you know, I'm in an area, I moved out of the way. I sort of like, you know, to be with my wife, to move out of the area I'm from. I just wanted to get away from certain people or certain worlds. I was like, you struggle a bit with your mental health. And I thought Ant's book was just like incredible, how he breaks it down, how he talks about stuff. And also if you know, I find myself, if you message him, he's always there for, he's someone who just pushes you to sort of, you know, for your mind and stuff. You know, and it is, we talk about it all the time. And I think that's what I was, when you were in that show, you could see the, you know, like you said on here and you said on there, on that show, boxing was everything to you. And then you're not doing it, you know.
It's how gone.
Yeah. But then did you feel you as a person stepped up to that thing of going, oh, actually, I feel more? Did you feel like that?
Well, going on that show, I felt it was weird because I didn't think any personal information or life was going to come out. I really didn't, because I just thought I'll keep it hidden. These guys don't know me from Adam. They're not going to draw anything from me. I'll let them know what I think they should know in my life. But, you know, little did I fucking know that everything would come out. I think that the toughest part was, it was just a mental battle, you know, chat battle with yourself. I was someone who I think Ant could relate to me. Said to me, I see so many familiarities in myself and you. And I was like, but you're a soldier. I can't ever compare myself with someone like him, because I rate him so highly. But I said, in the first episode I had with him, like, I haven't seen the series, but the first time I ever went in that room with him and sat down, he said, I always remember it, sticks in my mind. I said, I haven't seen it back, but I know definitely it's the first time I went in the room. He says to me, why are you frustrated? And I was like, I'm not frustrated. And I was basically questioning myself. He was saying, why are you frustrated? And I was going, I'm not frustrated. Why am I frustrated? And I was saying to him, I've achieved everything I set out to in my life. I've got a lovely family. I've got everything's right. You know, I've won world champions. I've fulfilled my lifelong dreams. Everything's, so why would I be frustrated? And he was like, you're frustrated. I can see it in your face. And I was like, I'm not. No, I'm not. And then, mate, literally as the days went on, the fucking shit just came to the forefront. And I was like, I don't know what this guy's putting in the fucking food, but he's putting something in it that's making me draw out what the fuck's up with me. But I think as men, we all have similar problems and similar things going on in our lives. It's just how we combat them and how we use it. And he just has a fantastic way of doing it. He really does. I got on with him great. And everyone else, I mean, Leon Lockheed was, you know, the perfect individual for me to be in and around, because he's obviously going through things in his life. He's been through a lot of stuff. And there was other people there, mate, I'd say, who I got on great with. You know, there was Nicky Sanderson, there was Hans Skelton, all other good people. But it was just something that I needed to do at that time. And I didn't see it coming from a mile away the way it was going to get me. It was mentally one of the toughest things I've ever done. I've had so many boxers come to me saying, was it as hard as it really looked? And I said to them, mate, listen, you haven't even scratched the surface of how hard it was. I said, in my mindset, when I got off the plane in Inverness, I was thinking, right, it can't be as bad as it's being portrayed on the TV. Honest to God, Tom, this is what I was thinking. I was thinking, about 11 o'clock at night, we're going to go to the dorm, and then someone's going to come in 10 minutes later, knock on the door, come on, guys, we'll be hotel over the road, and then that's where you sleep, and then we come back here, and then you just really come and wake up here as if you've just been sleeping here all day. That first night, he put me on that fucking, it wasn't even a bed. I don't know what the fuck it was. My feet hung off the end of it. It was dead noisy. I had to sleep in my clothes. I stunk. And that first night, I thought, I was every single night I went to sleep in that fucking place, I would sit there thinking, every single night, what are you doing this for? Just get up and walk out. Just, you've got nothing to prove. You've absolutely done it. Every single night, mate, every time I lied down, I thought, just go. What are you doing here? You've got nothing to prove. You've done everything you wanted to do in your life. Just leave. And then every time I get up and sit on the bed, I go, you can't quit your shit house. Because I've never quit anything. That's the only thing that kept me in there was the pure sheer determination of, I can't quit.
But that's that, and that's the most amicable thing. Do you think, because it was interesting as well, because I grew up watching, West Ham fan, but when I was at school, we used to go and watch Wimbledon quite a lot. And Fash was...
Fucking hell.
He's a complex guy, isn't he? Because like yourself, right? I mean, I fucking love my football and but he never felt, even when, like, just as he's, like, how he sort of handles himself. Like, when you talk about, like, the banner...
Yeah, he didn't have it's weird because he was the one who going in, he was only one of three people. I didn't know anyone, by the way. I knew three of them when I got there. Sorry. But I'd heard Joey Essex's name. I knew John Fashion who was, I knew Ron Peter Turner was, and obviously everyone knows fucking Katie Price is.
Yeah.
So I knew they was. I didn't know Lockie, I didn't know Yasmin, I didn't know Nikki, I didn't know Helen Skelton.
She was incredible, Nikki, right?
Yeah, mate, strong girl, really, really strong, mate. As I called her, the toughest bitch in Manchester. tough people. But I didn't know them. So when I respected Fash, like I remember pulling Fash the first day in the hotel. We were doing a press day before we left, and I was like, bloody hell, mate. I've got so much respect for you. I said, you were part of the team that nearly relegated my team. And like, he didn't have any recollection of the day at all. It was just another game for Wimbledon, I suppose.
Yeah.
They had ever beat them 3-2 and stayed in the league. And we were 2-0 down. And we obviously all thought we were down. Maybe we were absolutely petrified. Barry Owen, I think I named Stuart twice, Barry Owen, and Barry Owen's volley in the goal. And then I was saying to Fash, mate, that was the most frightening day of literally one of the most frightening days of my life. If we go down that day, mate, you don't understand what football means. He's like, oh yeah, it was a good day and stuff like that. And I was like, mate, you lost. He just didn't have any recollection at all. But as time goes on, it was like he would say certain things and do certain things. Like he was adamant and letting people know how many Dan and Kratty or whatever the shit he does, I don't know. So I always had my eye on him thinking, I don't need a problem in here. So I'm obviously not going to have any problems with the staff. Got far too much respect for the thoughts. If he tries to put it on me in any way, shape or form, I said, this is not going to go down well. So I always had it in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
The day they got them boxing gloves out, mate, I thought, here we go. I thought, I am not fighting no one, I thought. And I told him, I was saying to Ollie, I'm not going to hit no one. He said, you do as you're fucking told. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to leave if you ask me to hit someone. He went, I've seen you hit people before. And I said to Ollie, yes, you have seen me hit people before. I said, but they were athletes trained to fight me. I said, you've never seen me hit an innocent person who can't defend themselves. He said, just fucking get on with the task, will you? So I thought, okay, I wasn't going to quit once again. So I thought, I'll just let someone beat me up. Anyway, goes on. Ant comes up, puts the head guard on me. He said, don't hurt anyone. I said, I'm not going to punch anyone. I just told Ollie. He said, just do as you're fucking told. Don't hurt anyone. So they're all coming at me straight away. He let, I think, 8 or 9 people attack me at once.
I
can deal with that. There's no problem. But Fash come towards me. So I just put my shoulder straight into his solar plexus there and I just shoved him with my solar plexus and he went. Let him know me straight away. Do not try and steal one on me while everyone's knocking the fuck out of me. The actual person who hit me the hardest was Helen Skelton. She punched me on the back of the ear and fucking shook me skull inside. And I was like, you fucking chatty. It was mad, mate. It was good. But as I say, Fash, I found just a bit odd at times and some of the things he'd say and do were a bit strange. But that's Fash. A couple of people messaged me after it and said, I'm happy you put him in his place. He used to bully us when he was at fucking Millwall. But I don't know. He was just a bit of an odd bod for me. You know,
he had that way about him, didn't he? And I mean, the bit of... at the end where you thought Ant was giving it, I don't know if you saw it, where you thought Ant was giving
seen
it.
I haven't seen it. Everyone's told me, so everyone's put on social media, and so, but I haven't actually watched that, so
it's,
I can only imagine it's cringeworthy.
Yeah, and also because it's a weird one, because I didn't meet Ant through that world. I've met him through, you know, various, you know, sort of things, industry things, games, whatever, networking things, and but he's like, I think, one of the most friendly straight away. You get on with him, you know. But it was, yeah. So when I first met him, he was like, oh, you know, yeah, here's my number, you know, just text you or whatever. So when Fash that happened with Fash, I was like, fucking level, fucking A-grade bellend to fucking
I still haven't seen it. You know what? One day I will watch it, but I don't know if it'll be anytime soon. But I will watch it at some point. But it was just being in there, mate, was enough.
Mate, I'll tell you the bit I fucking, my heart went out to you. I like, and this is someone I, and I scaffolded you, whatever, but I fucking, the heights, man. I was like, I couldn't have, like, it's
I've
a one thing.
I've tried conquering them for years, mate. I've tried doing it. I've done bungee jumps into water in Ayanapa when we were younger, and I just can't get over it. But then, it, you know, I was at a point where I was comfortable with it, and then after losing my brother-in-law, that just accentuated it 20 times over.
Yeah, of course.
Nowadays, it's not that I'm scared of the actual height, it's just that what's going through my mind when I'm up there.
Yeah.
And that, and I can't, I'm trying to flip that round, but I can't. So every time I go up high, I just think about that, mate. But, Doing the abseiling down, I remember doing the one first one going down backwards. I can do that because I just won't look down, I'll just keep looking up. And
yeah.
Before you know it, I'll be at the ground. Once I'm at the ground, I'm all right. But when they made me come down looking forward, I mean, just broke me in two.
When we did League of Their Own in Germany, right? And we had to abseil off the tallest, no, it was in Holland, sorry, this fucking massive tower thing. So I fly out with AJ, and on the way out there, AJ's like, what's this abseil thing we're doing and all that? And I'm like, it's like this big tower. And he's like, yeah, I did a thing on Bear Grylls like that. Are you doing it? Yeah. And I was like, I was 50-50 ahead in my head tone, right? And I was like, I don't know. And he was like, yeah, we'll do it, brother. It'll be cool. Yeah, we'll do it. Right. So I'm like, yeah, actually, I'm going to do it. So we get out of the fucking car. I was like, actually, gets into my head. Like, yeah, you could do it, big man. Fucking you should be, whatever. Right. So we get there. They turn around to the people, turn around. When we get there and go, okay, Tom, AJ, you know, we're going to go up there. Freddie and Jamie are going to go off, then you both go off. And I'm like, yeah, I'm pumped. I'm looking forward to it. And AJ went, I can't do it because of insurance reasons. And I went, you fucking what? And he went, yeah, no, I can't do it because of insurance reasons. I went, but you just, he went, yeah, because I knew that you would blouse out if I told you that. So you need to do this for yourself, big man. And I'm like, fuck off, right. So I get to the top of the fucking tower, see Freddie and Jamie do it, and even Freddie's like, and Freddie's not scared of fucking, like Freddie's mantra is a bit like yours. Freddie's is like, it fucking kills me, it kills me, I don't give a fuck, like something's got to, do you know what I mean? You know, so he gets up there, Freddie goes down, and then they're like, Tom, are you ready? And I'm going down with this woman who runs it, right? So I'm going down, I'm like you, I'm, you get lowered down, so you're like hitting it like that. Yeah. So I'm like, I'm not going to let down, da-da-da. And whatever, and then the harness starts creaking, really like fucking creaking, and my fucking ass is, and I turn to the woman and I'm like, this fucking harness is creaking loads, it's fucking creaking loads. Like, why is it creaking? She's like, oh, it shouldn't be creaking. Why? How much do you weigh? And I go, I'm about 22 stone. And she was like, 22 stone? Oh my God, you're the heaviest person who's ever been on this. You shouldn't be on it. God. And I tell you, right. Even if you watch it back, so I'm halfway down, right? And she tells me, like, you shouldn't be on this thing. I'm honestly, I start having panic attacks. You can hear me, I'm nearly crying. And I just basically let rip, get down there as quick as I can, I burn all my hands and all that. I hit the ground and I was literally just on the ground with Freddie going, you're all right, big man, you're all right, lad. I'm like, Fred, just give me a second, mate. I want to cry.
Mate, that's fucking just
horrible. Stress. It's a fucking nutty show to do that. I don't think people, because when I saw you did a plane one, I was like, that. I think that's the craziest one of.
Do you know what? Being actually on the, when the plane's in the sky, it's not that bad. I can deal with that. Listen, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die. But the scariest part was climbing on the plane. Because it's being that 10 feet off the floor, I can fall here and break my leg or I can break my neck or whatever. When I'm up in the sky, ain't no one coming off that. I mean, if they come off, I remember saying to the producers, I said, if I come off this plane when it's in the sky, I said, you know, the insurance obviously massive, my family, Sam, for the rest of their lives, happy days. But if I fall off the plane climbing on it and break my neck, then that's on me, that's not on them. So fuck it. But when I was in the sky, I was like, I am not coming down before Jamie, so I would have stayed up there all week. But it was good, mate, it was good. Another fucking crazy episode that took part in.
Oh mate, I love that one. When I went to them and I did the ice skating one, all they said to me was like, Tony Bell is ice skating. And I watched your one thinking, as a big guy, I was like, and I thought, Tony seemed like he got it. I spent the whole time on the ice. It was the most demeaning thing I've ever done in my life, trying to ice skate. Literally, I was like so Bambi all over the place.
It's embarrassing, mate. I'm fucking terrible, but you just got to keep pushing, mate, and trying. It's all you can do.
Mate, it's, yeah. I'll tell you what, Tony, it's genuinely been, it's a pleasure sitting here always, just chatting to you.
Always been a pleasure, mate. I'm so absolutely great.
A great chat with Tony there. One of my favourite people from the world of boxing. I was dying to get him on the podcast, so happy he's done it. You've been listening to The Punchline, episode 5 from Matchroom Boxing, supported by JD Sports. I'm Tom Davis. See you next time.